Broadcast live from the centre of England and New South Wales, this is Waffle On About the Martians Are Here. Welcome to this mini waffle episode, the mini waffles that slip greasily in between the big waffles. Never thought I'd say the word greasy on a podcast before, but still, carrying on, we have a special guest with us today, a man who's quite well known over in Australia. I'm just bigging you up, by the way. We have Stefan Sornock. Hello, Stefan.
Hi, I'm not sure that I'm all that well known. Well, I'm well known within my family.
Well, yeah, you've got quite a big family, and I was just really moving away from the word greasy more than anything.
I'm going to say it had a few connotations, yes.
Yeah, I'm starting to forget having those beers earlier on.
Yeah, I was just thinking, are we doing a special on Maccas here?
So let's explain who you are first and whereabouts in Australia you actually are.
Okay, all right. Well, you may actually be able to hear the fact that there are lots of birds carrying on at the moment because it's very early in the morning and they're having a good old time, and I'm sitting right in the outback almost here because I'm in a part of Australia that's in the Blue Mountains. And at this time of day, there's all sorts of creatures. The possums just disappeared before. So yeah, that's where I am, is in the Blue Mountains in Australia. And it was actually the Blue Mountains and the towns nearby where I live that inspired me to write the story. And in fact, most of the locations in the first part of the story are within about 15 minutes of where I live, which makes it pretty depressing, really, because sit there thinking, oh my god, this bit just disappeared.
Yeah, that's quite upsetting, really, to be fair, considering how beautiful the areas that where you live are. You've just casually destroyed them.
Well, it's even worse when I had to go to the show this year, the Hawkesbury show, and you know, we went on the Ferris wheel specifically to get photographs so that we could go and sort of put them up and show people exactly what we were talking about in terms of the RAF base and the area there. And I'm sitting there as I'm going, oh. And none of this is probably going to be here by the end of the story.
No, for those people that have tuned in to Waffle On, regular listeners, which of course you will be a regular listener if you've suddenly got this on your RSS feed, Stefan is the producer and writer of The Martians Are Here, a podcast which is basically it's an ongoing sci-fi story. And as you've just described, quite a few bits of Australia have suddenly gone missing for strange reasons. It is an unusual story in itself that such great landmarks as when you describe Sydney suddenly disappearing. Is that subconscious, the fact that it's a business district and you just thought that would be quite nice?
Well, coincidentally, I in the year before I did before I started writing The Martians Are Here, I was actually doing research for the novel that comes after this, and my original vision of the backstory was global warming. Mm. And I was doing a lot of research on the tidal effects and let's say the sea level rise is what would happen to Sydney, and I actually had a map of Sydney on my computer that I used to play with every day that basically, you know, and other parts of the world, because it was set in multiple parts of the world, where you would see where the sea level would rise to. And most of Sydney was going under.
Yeah.
And I got to the point where I went, hang on, look, for when I went and started writing the Martians Here, I went, no. Let's not have Sydney go under. Let's just get rid of it.
So your story has quite a few main characters, and they're all quite important to the story. And unlike a lot of sci-fi stories, you get a main character and then you get a couple of, I wouldn't say insignificant characters, but just sort of like people who float in and float out. Yours doesn't. Yours actually has characters that are important throughout. Who's the most important one? Who's the most important character, do you think, in your story?
Oh, don't ask me that question, because that answer changes every week. If you're going to take on pure airtime in terms of the character that has the most time to do things, it's definitely Mickey. Mickey has got the largest pieces, and I really hate to say that he's the central character, mm-hmm. because each of the characters, it's like having bits of a jigsaw. Each of the characters has a definite role to play, and you couldn't have any one of the characters without the others. So it's almost impossible to say there is a central character. But in terms of the one that gets the most airtime, it's definitely Mickey. And then the one who probably gets the second most airtime would be Sarah.
Yeah, which is weird, because after listening to the 12 episodes that have been put up, I would have said Jones. Only because the fact that Jones seems to be connected more to all the those two characters, to Sarah and to Mickey. So he seems to be the pin, and the thread comes off. I'm not saying that he's an, but from listening to it, Jones always seems to be there.
Yes, I think you're right. Jones is what I call a catalyst character. He's important to creating things happening. Like he actually has, I think early on he has a very catalyzing effect on Mickey, because he sort of challenges Mickey's view of everything. Like Mickey's, I find Mickey probably he's not a difficult character to write. Actually, I find Mickey a very easy character to write, but mm-hmm. I want to slap him every week because he's just such a sulky bastard. I'm sitting there writing, and when I'm writing, I'm going, oh, I'm feeling depressed. Oh, that's right, I'm writing Mickey.
He's a whinger, isn't he?
That's right. Whereas when I'm writing Jones, I'm feeling, oh, okay, let's get out there. He's sort of, look, Jones is really the Australian character. He represents Australia in the story. You've got the United Nations happening there, because you've got representatives from England and Australia and America.
You say that when you're writing Mickey, that you kind of like, you sit there and almost have your head in your hands when you're writing it, because you think, God, you're such a whinger. It's a cliche thing. It's a cliche question to ask, but it has to be done. Is Mickey based on anyone? Or is he based on, you after a bad day's work?
No, how Mickey is not how I am after a bad day's work. After a bad day's work, nobody goes near me. No. Actually, that's the funny thing, is Mickey isn't actually based on, in the case of probably most of the other characters, they are probably based on someone somewhere. Mm-hmm. But Mickey's the only one that isn't. He's based more around, I guess, in a way, he's because he starts at one point in the story, which is he's at a cusp point in his life. He's at that transition really between, that early adulthood and really becoming a man. I guess mm-hmm. this is in a way, if you want to, take the more classical storytelling thing. This is, for Mickey's story, because really it's not just Mickey's story. It's all of the characters, you're going to get their story right the way through. And so it's not just Mickey's story. But Mickey's story is that he's becoming a man, and that's really what it is. And that's, in essence, that's why he's such a whinger, because he's at that cusp, And the worst part for him is he's at that cusp. He's just starting to become a man. Okay, he's in his late 20s, and, most people sort of transitioned into manhood probably a little bit before that. But he really is is at that cusp. He's sort of a late developer. And you know, for him, it was challenging enough to make that transition. And then all of a sudden he had a bad day and woke up and the world had changed rather dramatically.
Yeah.
And so that's his story. Originally, when I actually – the funny thing is that when I wrote the original script for The Martians Are Here, the first six episodes, I wrote them in first person from Mickey's point of view, but it just didn't work because Mickey is too sulky and it really just came off as being one great big long whinge. You know, and I just went, look, nobody's going to listen to this because basically nobody wants to hear somebody sulking for six, for a couple of hours. I mean, good grief. It actually forces you into that mode when you get in there. And you know what? It just got too hard emotionally.
Your other character, Jones, he's, as you say, totally the opposite of Mickey, which is ironic because in how well they get on.
Yeah, but I think that has more to do with Jones than Mickey.
Well, for obvious reasons.
I know that there is a link between them because Jones, had a friend who looked exactly like Mickey. But the other thing about that was that if anybody in the rest of the world has gone out and seen Crocodile Dundee or watched, Steve Irwin, the Crocodile Hunter or whatever, and, you've seen that larger-than-life Australian character, the reality is that the archetypical Australian is everybody's mate.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter how long I've known you. You're my mate. And that's why I think, I wrote Jones as being very Australian. He takes to Mickey so quickly. Yes, there's that connection between them. But just naturally, the gregarious Australian is everybody's mate. You walk into a pub and everybody's mates. This may be the first time you're sharing a beer, but you're mates. That's the culture of Australia. So Jones really culturally fits for Australia. Occasionally he drops – the one area in which Jones probably drops out of being Australian is the fact that the Australian way is very much a she'll be right, mate. That's the Australian way. Whereas Jones has it's a different kind of acceptance because Jones actually, he has that ability because he's been in the military. He has that acceptance that things can go wrong because, obviously he's dealt with things going wrong. He's seen people die. He's, he's been through war. So he's a little bit different for that. But he still has that she'll be right, mate attitude, but not quite the same because, obviously his experiences have changed a little bit there. But he's still very Australian and he's still very blokey. I mean, you'll get plenty of time yet to see Jonesy and all his blokiness.
Yeah, you do. Jones, I find Jones probably one of the most interesting out of all the characters. Just as soon as I heard how you wrote him, and when I was listening to Rick's excellent narration of the story, Jones was the one that, as you say, you'd like to have a beer with him. He does come across as that guy that you could meet him and automatically feel a comfort with. But he is a really interesting character. There's a lot of I hate to use the onion analogy, of lots of layers, but unfortunately I think there is a lot of layers to Jones, and that's what makes him interesting.
Well, I think that the thing with Jones is you there's a lot more layers to come. And yes, you're going to be that's actually the beautiful part about the Jones character is almost every time you see him you're pulling back a layer. He surprises every time because it's not in that unpredictable. See, that's the thing, is that you've got a character like Sir Daniel who is just totally unpredictable. You don't know what he is going to do next. Whereas Jones is an unpredictable, and yet you're surprised.
Yes.
Because he goes to that next level each time as a character, and that's why I kind of like him, because he's not that static character. He's kind of, he has that ability to go to that next level. And he's a pretty genuine character because, in terms of the last episodes and stuff like that, he's genuinely scared. He's been through Iraq. He's been through war. He's seen people blown up, and yet he's in a situation that is horrible, and he is genuinely scared. So he's real. He's not fake in that, he's not just that macho, oh, I'm not scared, there are some situations where, you really ought to be be a bit worried.
Yeah, but he's the way that you vote him is like you can tell that he's bothered, but because he's got that Australian kind of humour in it, where it's the fear is hidden with the odd bit of humour. And I think that's yes. what makes him a likable character. You just mentioned Sir Daniel there, the total opposite of Jones in the humour there with him, but he's certainly not Australian.
No,
that's for certain. In dress sense and in accent, but he's one hell of a complex character.
Oh yes, I love Sir Daniel. Sir Daniel is kind of, you know, when you talk about characters being based on something, I think, you know, really deep down inside, everybody has, you know, a good part and a bad part. And deep down inside, I think that Sir Daniel is my bad part. I know that there is a certain affinity there because I love writing him. He's in terms of the character that I have the most fun writing, Sir Daniel is it, because he is just, look, he's unrestrained. He is unpredictable. He doesn't mind what he does. He goes about things in a way that is counterclockwise to how most people would expect people to do things. He's very scheming. He's always in control, and yet he shouldn't be. You know, you look at him and he's this fat, pompous, bloated, you know, Englishman. He was deliberately that way because his appearance is all of this guy who's really, you know, lost it. Why would this guy be in any way, you know, an in control person, and yet he is really in control. And from the first moment you see him, and that's the encounter between himself and Corporate Jim, he just exudes that calm and that control in that situation, and you know, and he takes it right up. Like, he's up to this point, you know, in the story so far, nobody has really taken on Corporate Jim and won, and it'll be a good long while before anybody does. Mm. And yet, the very first person who he encounters is Sir Daniel, who takes it up to him and really gets the better of him. So yeah, and Sir Daniel's interesting. I don't want to call him the devil character because he can be that whole tempter type character, but I don't really think that that's sort of almost selling him short, because that's just too easy, if you know what I mean. He's a lot more complicated than that.
For, as you say about Sir Daniel, he comes across, he looks, he's described as a very shabby figure. In fact, he's called, you know, the shabby man at one point. But he's got that air of in control and danger. There's definite danger to him, but said in a almost sort of like the I hope this doesn't come across as an insulting comic, it's not meant to be, but if you was to think of the ultimate style James Bond villain, you'd have someone who's smarmy but calm, who looks smug but charming, all in one, who could sit there and cross his legs and go like that and then kill you. Do you know what I mean? And that kind of thing. Yes. And to me, that's how Sir Daniel comes across.
What you've just come across with Sir Daniel is exactly how I feel about him. I deliberately leave a vacuum there for, in terms of how he looks and what he does, so that I set the scenes up, but then because his dialogue makes it very clear that he, you know, whatever he is saying, he could kill you in any second. It then allows you to in your own head, in your own imagination, to build that picture of that person. And I half suspect that, you know, that if you ask five people what Sir Daniel looks like in any given scene, you're probably going to get small variations, but I don't think any of them are going to be nice.
No. You've got two female characters in this story, and two very strong female characters as well. And considering the age difference of them, they are both strong, you know.
Very different female characters too.
Very, very different. Let's just bring up Sarah, really, as she's the oldest. What's Sarah all about? Because she comes across as someone who, she doesn't need anybody, but then suddenly you almost feel she does. Do you know what I mean? There's that real balance of scales going on with her.
Look, you know what? I don't know. In fact, pretty much the whole way through the whole of the first part of The Martian to here, I almost felt, you know, like, gee whiz, anybody who's reading this, knowing that this is a male writer, is going to go, this guy's just a misogynist. You know, look what he does to her. Breaking arms, he's got aliens attacking her, he's got all these horrible things happening to her, so Daniel's not exactly nice to her. But the thing is that with Sarah is that that stuff she can cope with. Mm. You know, she's really strong. She's got this, she's this really methodical scientific person. She works through everything so clinically, and this is, she's in her element. The reality is that for Sarah, a broken arm is no problem. You know, for most people, a broken arm would present an obstacle. For Sarah, that's no real obstacle. And that I think is probably the reason why, of all of the characters in the first part, she has the most that goes wrong with her, is because mentally she's the one who can cope with it. Like, it's not like she ends the first part in total disarray and she's falling apart.
No.
You know, for all that happens, she almost seems to get stronger every time something happens. It's quite the opposite. You know, for her, it's this is you know, getting the blood flowing. For her, though, the disconnect for her and her failing is that very thing right at the very beginning, which, you know, where I talk about her struggling to deal with the world. She is on this boat because she can deal with the monsters, but an ordinary person comes up and says hi to her, and that's a struggle. She has, she has a makeup kit, and yet she doesn't, you know, like, it's hidden in the bottom of the drawer, and it's her most feared item. She's, yeah, quite unusual in that way, I think, because, and that's one of the reasons why I really like Sarah, is because, yeah, she's not, that's, it's not just that she, you know, like, there are women who basically go, well, look, I don't wear makeup. This is who I am. This is how I am. And that's fine. No problem. Mm-hmm. But she's got actually a fear of it. And that is connected, I guess, with her fear of people, her fear of things. Like, she can control science because she can understand it. She can analyze it and it makes sense. And even the monsters, to some degree, she can rationalize them. Whereas to her, people are just so unpredictable and so difficult that, you know, she just can't cope with people. And for Sarah, that's, you know, when we talk about Mickey's journey, where being, you know, that transition into manhood, Sarah's journey is that at some point through this, she's going to be, you know, reconnecting with the world. Obviously, it's not going to be quite the same world that she left. It's going to be a very, very different world.
Yeah.
But that's going to be very challenging for her because she doesn't get a choice. So, you know, that's going to be her journey, her challenge, and that's why I think, you know, she's got that contrast of, she's this really strong woman who can, you know, have her arm broken and still, you know, go to battle with monsters, and yet she has a makeup kit that terrifies her.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, especially with the episode in which her boat is being it's almost smashed to pieces. You know, she's lost the mast, she's lost control of the boat, her arm's bust, she's in trouble, but she's still, as you say, she's calculating everything. She, if I was to say it, not that I believe in the stars or anything, but she's got Virgo written all over. You know, she's organized, you know, through. And I say that because I'm a Virgo, so it's like, I can say that. But she is kind of like in control, but not.
For Sarah, she distrusts people because she doesn't believe they're real. You know, she can trust monsters because they're real in that unreal sense, but you know what I mean, like, she's facing up these things, she can see them, she can analyze them, she can, okay, she can't understand them at this point, but scientifically she can comprehend them.
Yeah.
Whereas and that makes them real, but you can't apply science to people. So for her, that is really hard, and I admire her as a character because she is just so strong, and yet she is very vulnerable.
Yeah. Is Sarah based on anyone?
Both of the Sarah and the Rose characters, I guess, are based on very different women who like my growing up, like our family is a very matriarchal family, and so I had a lot of different females in my life and all of my life, and you know what, I've got four daughters, so. I have women telling me what to do every day of the week. I won't necessarily say that I always listen, but, you know, I'm a guy, okay? But really, Sarah is modeled after, I guess, the matriarchal women in my family, my mother, grandmother, aunts, and the like. The tough as nails women who could really cope in any situation at all. And yet, when it came to that emotional part of life, they were really quite vulnerable. And they have that contrast. So I guess, in a way, she's sort of not really based, but she's sort of representative, I guess, of the matriarchal women in my life. Not that there are many of them that are scientists. I've got one of my aunts is a scientist, and in a weird coincidence, I've sort of learned a lot more about her in the last year, and it turns out that she shares more than a little bit in common with Sarah, except for the fighting monsters and, you know, having weird dreams bit. But yeah, I didn't really know that prior to that. So it wasn't sort of that she was based. It was more just a coincidence. And let me put it this way. It came as no surprise when I sort of discovered that that's what she was like, because of the way the matriarchy on both sides. That's the funny thing, is on both my father's and my mother's side, they're both matriarchies.
Yeah, excellent. And so what about Rose then? Because she's a very young girl, and I'll let you talk about Rose and then I'll say what I thought when I when I emailed you the other week, when I was second guessing stuff and trying to see if I could break your locker of tight scripts that you have there. But she is how can I put it? I think she's a lot more adult than what she seems.
Well, yes, she seems more adult. But you know what? In a funny kind of way, 10-year-olds can do that.
Yeah.
They can be. That's the unpredictable thing about 10-year-olds, is that they can one minute be this really mature, unbelievable person, and then the very next second they'll race off and do something incredibly crazy and silly yet childish. And the fact is that the time lag between those two events can be seconds.
Yeah.
So that's, I guess, part, and that will actually, you know, the episode that I'm writing at the very moment, without adding in any spoilers, brings forth that immaturity within Rose a little better, because up until now, circumstances have sort of forced her to be that person, and she's not really had a breath. Like, from the very, when you say that she's, you know, that very mature, you go from the first encounter with Mickey, where she, you know, she basically connects with him almost instantly, but then the very next thing she does is basically, you know, take him out and make him play cricket, which for Mickey is, you know, near that cricket is kind of Mickey's version of the makeup kit for Sarah. That's sheer mortal terror, and you know, and Rose basically goes and makes a real fool of him.
So really what you're saying is Mickey is the Australian cricket team at the moment. Is that what you say? Yeah. That they're afraid to play cricket.
one World Cup and all of a sudden the English can play cricket. Rose in a lot of ways is, reflective of, in part she's based around my daughters, in part she's based on every girl that I grew up with.
Yeah.
Because the girls that I grew up with in the 1970s, you know, at that age, you know, at the age where it's just gotten interesting when you play catch and kiss in the dark and that sort of stuff, you know, that's a sort of that more mysterious age. And the girls that I grew up with, it was a sports mad town that I grew up in. In fact, there were only two things in the town I grew up in. There was agriculture and there was sports, and there was nothing in between. And because it was such a sporty town, there were a lot more, I guess, I won't say tomboyish girls, but there were a lot of hugely capable girls, very athletic, very strong, and very capable. And also just, I think, with the teachers that we had at that time who were all, you know, they'd all been through the war and they all had a lot of life experiences to share. A lot of the kids that were around that time were a lot more worldly, if you like. We would talk about things that my children now, having experiences with them, they don't even know what they are. Like they know a fraction, I guess, of the world that I knew when I was there. Maybe that's because at that age, because maybe the world was a bit smaller, maybe it was a bit easier, and also maybe because we had those teachers who had been through the war and everything like that, they shared a lot more of the world, and so we were just naturally that way. But that was a lot of the girls that were there, and I guess the other part of that is that my three girls, I have three girls of my own and a stepdaughter and a stepson, and my three girls, I became a single father to them, and when my youngest was 12 months, just a little over 12 months. Mm-hmm. And it is very interesting to see the differences between them and, say, other children, because for the bulk of their developing life, my eldest, not quite, she's a little different, but the two next two down, the for the majority of their developing life, they had a single father, not a mother, and they really didn't have a large mother role at all. They're very different because male nurturing is a little different to female nurturing, because, you know, when a child scrapes its knee, you know, a woman will fuss and bother and do all of that kind of stuff, which is all, you know, natural and fine. Mm-hmm. But if a guy sees a child scrape its knee, it's like, you know, get off the ground, princess, and if you pick it, stop crying now. You know, guy nurturing is just different, let's say. And consequently, they are a little different because they are a bit tougher. They don't react in the same way. Like my youngest, about 3 weeks ago, we were play fighting because she does karate, and we were play fighting in the kitchen, as we often do. And I, you know, decided to show off my karate prowess, which, by the way, is non-existent, and I aimed a kick at her, and in my way completely miscued and aimed for completely the wrong bit and got the completely wrong bit. Now, normally she'd just basically, you know, ignore it and laugh at me, but on this particular occasion she decided to try and block it for some reason, and she got her hand in the wrong spot. And her hand was basically, by the next day, it was black because she really had collected herself and it hurt.
Yeah.
Well, two things happened with that. First thing was, yes, she did cry a little bit, but she not more than a couple of minutes after it, basically gave me a well-aimed kidney punch and told me that it was my fault that her hand hurt because I was so crap at kicking. And the very next night, she wrapped up her hand, bailed me up in the kitchen when nobody else was around, and said, right, now we're having round two.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
And proceeded to teach me how to do karate.
You see, the one thing, you, at least you know full well that when your daughter does get to the age of dating and bringing the boyfriend home, you know that you're not going to have to worry about kicking his ass because she'll do it already. So.
Yes, I've already told her that when she's 16, I'm going to be there with her boyfriend going, look, please understand, this is going to hurt. And I mean that literally.
She knows where your kidneys are. That's the
Oh, yeah. You know what? She's practiced every punch, kick and imaginable on me, and I have plenty of bruises. And she did remind me when her hand had started to heal. She did remind me that, Dad, that's one bruise for me, but it's still about 100 for you.
Yeah. Oh, dear. I bet you sat there grumbling slightly, but also with an essence of pride.
Yes.
The way I saw those, because of the Oz reference, the Wizard of Oz references, which I detest. I don't know what it is. I hate that film. But saying that, I have bought it again on DVD to go and watch now, because it was when I was young, and it wasn't because I was scared by it or anything like that. I don't like The Wizard of Oz, and so for me, I already have a little bit of a thing for Rose that sticks in my head of, I don't quite trust her here, and the way she is with people, that she's suddenly so strong and so elderly. She, the way I saw her was being more older than Sarah, being more confident than Sarah, being more stronger than any character in the whole story. She seemed to be more in charge, and is indeed in charge at moments, as you say, when she tells Mickey to come on, and then the next minute she's playing kicker with it. And the same thing a little bit later on with when Corporate Jim's there. There's things that she does that a child you wouldn't imagine doing. You know, do you know what I mean? The way that she sees quite horrific things and almost doesn't affect her, almost like she's battle-worn or, you know, has seen so... You get the general who's been through five wars and doesn't think anything of sending out a man to his death because he's seen so many of it. You see the policeman who deals with crime every day, and so when someone says, my house has been burgled, they just go, oh, right. You know, that desensitized to anything. And that's how I started to see Rose as being the person in charge. And because I started to see her as being the person in charge of everything, I automatically assumed, you know, Rung, as you said, that she was the bad person in the whole thing. She was the as we said, almost like the devil figure. And that's how I started, you know, when you said, well, you know, you think about her and come back and say to me what you think. And that was my opinion, which as you said, was some bits are right, but quite a bit of it was wrong.
You know what? I think that you had it right, but probably your conclusions were not correct, because the thing that I think I said was you have to take into account, like, Rose seems like all of these things, okay? And this is also something that comes from the fact that another part of my background is that I worked in schools, and I had a lot to do with kids that were on drugs and damaged and so forth. For some reason, that wasn't my job or anything to do with it. It's just for some reason they gravitated to me. I just must have a particular label on my head, I think. But one of the things which comes out of that is you take a step back with Rose and you go back to that first episode where she arrives in episode 8. Now, her father, you know, basically murders a sibling and the mother and then kills himself.
Mm.
Now, nobody gets to those moments just like that. It's not something usual. Like, there has to be a backstory, if you like. And, you know, you wouldn't imagine, I guess in my head, I wouldn't imagine that the father just all of a sudden woke up one morning and went, you know, oh, look, I'm just going to top myself off. Yes, obviously he has, because the world is coming to the end. So this is his reaction to it.
Mm.
But there has to be something that brings him to that reaction. And that's why I think Rose is a little surprising, because it's amazing. As I said, I've dealt with a lot of damaged children, and you'd be amazed at how confident and in control they are from a very young age, because they have to be. And they give a false impression. And that's where the most interesting relationship to come, and I'll talk a little bit more about this with when I get into Corporate Jim, but I think the most interesting relationship to come of all is the relationship between Jim and Rose, because they as characters are, I guess they're two characters who probably shouldn't connect, and they've got probably, you know, the most dangerous relationship. But I'll go through that a bit more when I go through Jim. Well, Jim is by far and away the hardest character of all to write. Only because every word I write with Jim, I sit there going, oh my God, I hope nobody in Australia is listening to this, because at some point I'm going to get placards and pickets outside my door if they know where I live. And the reason for that is because in Australia, really the Aboriginal story is a mess. It is just a complete mess. And that's in part due to history. It's in part due to the fact that we really don't know how to deal with the Aboriginal people. And a large part of it is also the fact that, a bit like America, there are three Australias. There's the Aboriginal people, who are obviously the first owners of the land. There is the first fleet, and obviously the migrants that came, you know, in the 1800s and whatnot, with the first fleet. So they're sort of like the established families within Australia. So they're really kind of like the people from the Mayflower in America. The really early settlers who've got, if you would call, the longest roots in terms of white Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really where white Australia comes from, is those roots of the settlers that came with the first fleet and more the attitude that came with it.
Yeah.
But then from 1940s on, there is the third Australia, which is really I sort of bridge between the second Australia and the third Australia, because the third Australia is the migrant population that came post World War II, because obviously Australia's greatest population growth really since World War II has been migration.
Mm-hmm.
We have, you know, for example, the largest population of Greeks in the world in Melbourne, outside of Athens. Because there is that third Australia, my father, see, this is the funny thing. My father is part of the third Australia because he was born in Soltau, Germany, in a concentration camp, because my grandmother and grandfather were taken from Russia by force during the war and were working in concentration camps. And in order to escape the concentration camps, this is how serious it was. My grandfather buried my grandmother for 3 days in a box about 2 meters. Oh, sorry, not 2 meters, about 4 feet or so under the ground. So about a meter and a half or so under the ground with an air tube. For 3 days.
Really?
She was stuck in that box for 3 days, yes. In order, because at the time, this was at the end of the war when, Berlin was being invaded and all of that. And they were so fearful that basically that the servants and whatnot were just going to be killed. That was what they did. And my grandfather was nearly killed in the process. So it was a horrible time, but that's that was her experiences of life. And that really shaped her life, that event, I think, that, she went through great famine in Russia, when the Nazis came, because obviously as the Russians pulled back, they had the, the scorched earth policy and whatnot, and there was terrible famine. There was just, she had a lot of really hard things that happened in Europe.
Yeah.
So that's the background of my family of immigrants coming out to Australia from very difficult circumstances. And then making a life. They lived in a tent in a small country town called Mathoura. My grandfather cut logs for the railways for a living. So they really sort of worked their way through. And my father eventually went on to university, and he became well educated. And as in that second generation, obviously everything changed.
Yeah.
But that's the third Australia. And the thing is that the third Australia is pretty much not connected to the Aboriginal story, because they've all come with their own story.
Mm.
White Australia, however, has grown up with the Aboriginal story, because in Australia, in a lot of ways, White Australia, from the First Fleet, has defined the Aboriginal story in the last 200 years, because really it's the interaction between White Australia and Aboriginal Australia that has really set the Aboriginal people on their path. And some of it has been really good, but an inordinate amount of it has been really, really horrible. And that's why Corporate Jim is a really, really hard character to write, because, in a way he really does exemplify to me the best things in the Aboriginal people. For a start, he's very, very resilient. He's a little bit of his backstory, in the sense that, he grew up in a pretty rough town. He was very intelligent. He excelled at school. And the thing was that it was actually quite easy to write, because his school time is around the same time as my school time. And I actually went to school with a number of Aboriginals, and had a couple of really good friends. And you know what? When it came to academics, they achieved, but they never got recognition. And that was the thing, instead of them being celebrated, they were just totally ignored. And that whole part of his backstory there that you hear, where he was best in the school, but he was never given the reward for it, is very typical of my experiences of growing up in schools at that particular time. So that wasn't all that hard to write. But despite all of this, he goes on. He becomes a corporate lawyer, and he doesn't get mad. He gets even.
Yeah.
He becomes a corporate lawyer, and he becomes a better lawyer than any of the white men. And in a way, I've sort of modeled him on that part of his story is really modeled on several of what I call the more inspiring of the Aboriginal leaders who've gone on to become great orators and lawyers and so forth. So in that part, he represents that transition into the modern world. But then he has this defining moment in his story where he all of a sudden goes walkabout and he regresses from being this black man who, and I don't use the term in any way derogatory. That's how he sees himself as a character. And he basically goes from this character where he really, you know, he can do everything better than the white men and he knows it, to all of a sudden he goes back to his very traditional Aboriginal roots. So he goes from the modern world back to his traditional roots, and he goes the whole hog. He doesn't go part way, you know, he doesn't worry. He really throws out all of the modern thinking. And I think if I ever write this as a book, no editor's going to accept the character of Corporate Jim as he is. Because, for example, you know, he throws out all of the modern thinking. He goes back to just, you know, his nulla nulla, which is like a club, mm-hmm. and a spear, and that's it. He doesn't wear clothes. He doesn't, you know, he's back to the very basic implements that he needs to be able to survive, and that's it. And that's all he has. Everything else is manufactured on the spot. So he is in that way really, really hard to write, because there is just so many ways in which he could be considered there is no way for, I guess, somebody from, you know, what you would call white Australia, although strictly speaking, I'm probably not really from white. I'm more from an immigrant family. But there's no real way for you to write an Aboriginal character in a story and not upset somebody somewhere, because the fact is that my perception, not, you know, I've not walked in those shoes. I've not lived that life. I've alongside people in that life. But I've not walked in that life, so I can't say from personal experience. However, I really, really could not leave out Corporate Jim as a character, because A, he's such a strong character, and B, because, you know what, one of the things which really, really irritates me about I think fiction, and in the end I had to take a vote as to whether I was going to include him or not, and I got to that moment where I had to, and somewhere around then I listened to an episode of Treks in Sci-Fi, hi Rico, where he did a review on, you remember the Deep Space Nine episode where Sisko goes back and he's no longer a Starfleet officer, he's now a black writer in America. And he's telling stories, and it, you know, the whole idea of Deep Space Nine is just in his head. It's just a story. When I listened to that, that threw the vote in his favor to be in there, because the point of that story was that, you know, it was probably only in science fiction stories that those sorts of characters could exist, because everywhere else is all taken too seriously. So if you wrote it in a real fiction story, a character like this, you'd be torn to shreds.
Yeah.
Because people would say, look, this is real life. But in science fiction, because it's not really taken as being real life and doesn't get half the credit I think it deserves as a genre, you can almost get away with that sort of stuff. So that tipped my vote, was basically because it was a science fiction story, I could include him. However, having said that, I have to say it was a bit of a touch and go thing, because I just thought, oh look, I'm going to upset someone somewhere. But in the end, I felt that it was worthwhile. The more controversial part, I think, of Corporate Jim is what's to come. Is I've now paired up Corporate Jim, who is this, you know, very masculine, powerful Aboriginal character, with a 10-year-old girl.
Yeah.
And he's walking around naked. And that, I'm sort of writing in that part at the moment. And I have to say, I almost have nightmares about that, because, gosh, talk about breaking every rule of child welfare and, you know, every situation that probably should not happen is basically there. But the thing is that, this is the thing about Rose, is she doesn't see, you know, this is that creepy part about Rose, I guess. She doesn't see people in the way that, say, you and I see people. Rose sees people more as they are. So what she sees is that Corporate Jim is a good person underneath all of that. She doesn't see him as being, you know, a 6-foot-tall Aboriginal running around naked and whacking spears through people. She sees something different. So in a way, that pairing is, you know, is actually probably more natural than, say, you know, any other, because she sees just the person inside. But then, you know what? If there's a whole bunch of people out there who are quite uncomfortable with the idea of a 6-foot-tall anybody walking around naked with a 10-year-old girl, I can understand it. Rose as a character is going to face some serious challenges of her own. And Rose's story is actually probably an even longer story of her coming from this point where she is now to obviously, inevitably, she's going to be an adult. And that's the funny thing about Rose is that when Rose was the first of all of these characters, Rose was the first of them. I first wrote about Rose in my early 20s, but at that time she was about 25. So for me, I'm kind of imagining now back who that person was when she's 10 years old, which that's a lot of fun, actually.
It is, yeah, because it's, you've already, as you say, if you come up with a character at that age, you already know how she's going to end up. So you've got that lovely build-up of where you can go. I tend to, when I write the ending first. So, or not exactly the ending, but just have the idea of the basics of the ending. And then for me, then the rest of the story is easy because you know where you're going to build up to. And I think if doing that for a character is really a good idea, I think.
Well, absolutely. The first thing I did, and I actually totally agree with you there, because the first thing I did with all of these characters was define their end point, was to this is where they are going to end up in the story. This is how they all end. And because I knew how they were all ending, it's easier then to tell their story. Because you know then how much, for example, how much of the backstory is important. But you also know, for example, how much of the backstory is irrelevant. So you never go off and feel like you need to explain why, for example, you know, Jones picked on Freddie Nurk at school and why, you know, and why that person, you know, bit back and so forth. You know, there's just lots of little details in your life that you don't need. And you know what, with a character like Jones, I reckon everybody out there can work out a better backstory for Jones and me. You know, there is a pact to me between the writer and the listener or the reader, and that pact is that the writer will never treat the listener or the reader as an idiot.
Yeah.
The writer will always believe wholly and solely that the listener is in fact more intelligent than they are and can come up with better answers. And that's how I treat it, is, you know, all of my listeners are smarter than me, but definitely.
Well, there you go, listeners. You've just got a massive slap on the back there. So keep listening. Now, we've got to the end of are you classing this like a series one, or are you just letting it roll through? Because we've just got to the end of chapter 12, which almost feels like an end of a series. Are you thinking it that way?
It is. Yeah, it is. Well, see, I don't see it as a series. It's really three parts in a story, or three acts, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, very definitely that each of the three parts have got, they're part of the bigger story, but they're, each of the three parts is telling its own story, and very different stories, the three sets of stories, because, you know, the first one is obviously going to, or has just told, I guess, the beginning of everything, of where everything starts and the chaos that ensues. The second part, you're going to get more information, you're going to get more of the journey, and then, you know, the third part will deal with the consequences of all of these things. Just don't expect to get all the answers.
Yeah, well, that's good. I mean, I don't want to say what has happened at the end of chapter 12, only for the fact that people might be listening to this who actually haven't heard any of these stories yet and will go on to listen to them. It's a bit unfair to turn around and say what happens, but it's an awesome ending to this first part. It definitely ends on a what? How? Kind of scenario, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, in a way, both of them do, because, okay, when you get to the end of both. There's really two endings. There's the end of chapter 11, then there's the end of chapter 12, because yeah. that is where you see the two parties, if you like, diverging, and you see these the groupings. Whereas up to this point, it's been characters and quite separate from one another. Now the characters are starting to bunch up a bit more. So there's really two endings in chapters 11 and chapter 12 where the characters are starting to, if you like, align themselves with each other.
Yeah.
That is actually the tricky part is there's actually, that's actually been the tricky part of writing part one has been how to thread the story. And I hope I've got it pretty close to right.
Yeah.
Because you have parts in which, say, like in the early days, really, it's almost Sarah that dominates the story, you know, with her battle with the eels and everything like that. She's the action girl, and she's the one where the story is really at, is it Sarah. That's probably, you know, the big revelations, if you like, with Sarah. But then if you get to the later part of the story, the revelations move away from Sarah. You know, Sarah gets one or two little revelations of her own on a personal level, but the big action then moves from Sarah to the boys. Mm. And we get to see the boys and how they handle action, and, you know, some of them are macho and some of them are not so macho.
Is it going to be the next two parts? Will there be 13 episodes each, or will that slightly differ?
Part one was 12. The next one is 12. The last one is 10.
Right.
The plan is for 10. And I'm in discussions. It depends on whether I get the script finished in... I need to finish the script really early. I'm in discussions with Rick about a one extra part, which is an epilogue part, which covers off on... it's a bridge between... The Martians Are Here, which is, you know, the story that we're in at the moment, and then the next story, which is called Rose of Mars, which basically takes the story on further into the future, quite some way into the future. Not many of the characters from The Martians Are Here transition into the future story, but then mm-hmm. probably more of them you might expect.
Right, that sounds pretty interesting. You mentioned Vic there, so do you want to talk a little bit about our good man and production genius, Mr. Vic Moyer?
He is a genius, isn't he?
How did you get to meet up with Vic?
Now there's a story. To be honest, all this started back about December last year, when I bought an iPhone, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to find out what this whole podcasting thing is about. So I did a search online for, I thought, oh, well, I'll find myself a sci-fi podcast. And I found Treks in Sci-Fi, which is mm-hmm. the very, very first podcast that I downloaded. And I listened to one episode, and it just happened to be the first episode that I actually listened to just happened to be the very episode where Rico came on and announced, look, I've just lost my job and, you know, da-da-da-da-da. And I went, oh, you know, I almost felt guilty. You know, like I'm listening and I'm going, oh, you know, oh. and I went, okay. And I downloaded a heap of episodes, and cropping up throughout these episodes was this Rick Moyer, who, you know, he had this music. And he had, you know, and then I listened to the Moyer family episode, and I just cracked up laughing because Amy was on it. And, you know, here's this larger than life American, and his wife is just absolutely taking the mickey out of him at every step possible. Mm-hmm. And I just loved every minute of it. And I thought, oh, yeah. So I then thought, okay, I'm going to go out and I'm going to listen to his podcast, because I knew he had a podcast and he sounded really interesting. I'm going to listen to his podcast. And I downloaded an episode, and I must have downloaded the worst possible episode, because it was an episode of his podcast where he was doing a quiz on, you know, how godly you were or something like that, how close to God you were. And it included things like, you know, whether you could speak in tongues and all of this really, you know, heavy, full-on religious stuff. And I just went, oh, I'm not sure that I really want to listen to this at all. I'm just so, but I decided, oh, well, for the, you know, I'm not necessarily a person who likes to do things on first appearances. So I listened to two or three more episodes and I thought, you know what? I really like this guy. I really like what he's saying. So I wrote him a couple of emails, and we had a couple of emails that were just very basic emails. And I think I wrote him one longer one, and he responded a little bit. So, you know, like we'd had a couple of discussions, but nothing too serious. And listening to him and the music, I decided, you know what? I really think that this guy could do something for me. And we just... This was by September. We just released the first two episodes of The Martians Are Here, which we will be re-releasing at some point, which were done by my wife. And we'd done them at home and with some basic recording equipment. And you know what? I wasn't unhappy with them. I thought they were great. But I just thought, you know what? Rick is so passionate about sci-fi and his geeky stuff. And I just thought, look, this could work. And so anyway, I wrote off to him and I said, you know, what about it? And, you know, he sort of didn't quite jump at it. He said he'd do it, but he didn't quite jump at it. And so it sort of sat on the shelf for a little while. And then in January, I think it was, I got serious and I said, look, you know what? I'm going to do this podcast regardless. I really wanted it to work because we'd sort of gone, like we'd done two episodes and then stopped because we have five children. It's a difficult house.
Yeah.
finding the time to record was just impossible. So I wrote off to him. I said, look, I'm going to send you a script. Have a go at it and, you know, see what you think. And we'll just work it out. And, you know, how much are you going to charge me to do this was basically how I put it. And, and he, you know, look, he it was really, really nice. And he did it. And he sent me back that first episode. And, you know, within a very short space of time, he sent back, what do you think? What he didn't realize was that it took me, I think, 8 goes to listen to that first episode, because I'd listened, like it was 15 minutes long, right? I would get 2 minutes and then I'd have to run away because basically I couldn't cope with listening to my own writing being played back to me. So I'd listen to 2 minutes and then I can't cope. Okay, then I come. Okay, fine, I've got to listen to it. Oh, no. Eventually, after about 8 goes of this, I eventually got through the episode and I went, oh, look, you know what? It sounds really good. It sounded like it didn't suck. Anyway, let's put it that way. So I played it to one of my daughters on the way home and I said, okay, what do you think? And she said, I really like it. And I went, okay. And so we recorded a second episode, and which is actually episode 3. We recorded episode 1 first, and then we recorded episode 3. But, yeah, he had such a ball with it, and he was so passionate about it that it just clicked. From there, it just clicked. He got into the story. You know, obviously something in it challenged him creatively. And I think what really challenged him creatively was the fact that it was nothing that he was used to. For a start, the story was set in Australia. Well, he's from Washington in the US. Interestingly, Washington in the US, Washington State, is very, very similar to our Tasmania, but we're not in Tasmania in the story. Yeah. So that didn't help me very much. Like, I saw a video of him doing some stuff this week and I'm thinking, oh my goodness, that's Tasmania in the summer. And so he just clicked. Yeah. So Rick is just amazing. I mean, the most recent podcast that we did, Pyramid, Hi Mike, on that one, I just sent him, I don't know how many of your listeners have listened to it, and if you haven't, go and listen to it right now. I insist you, the very next thing you do after you finish listening to us waffle on is you go out and put The War of the Worlds a musical on, and if you haven't listened to it for a while, put it on, and if you listened to it 15 minutes ago, put it on anyway. Because I sent him that and I said to him, listen to this, because this is storytelling done. This is science fiction storytelling, but it's the music that tells the story, because you have a 50,000 word novel condensed to, yeah, probably maybe 2,000 words.
Yeah, this is the Jeff Wayne's War of the Worlds, isn't it?
That's the one, the Jeff Wayne's War of the World. Jeff Wayne is just, in my book, he's just an absolute genius. I think he just, I guess, look, it was the era. mm-hmm. this was the era in which musicals were done for all sorts of weird subjects, but this was probably the one and only science fiction musical that I think really has worked. There've been a couple of musical episodes, say, in Buffy the Vampire Slayer that were interesting,
yeah.
but the one that has really just from beginning to end worked is the War of the Worlds, because of the story that tells and the way that it tells the story. It's just incredible. I still get shivers every time I listen to it.
I was brought up on Jeff Wayne's War of the Worlds, always in my house and scared the living daylights out of me. And it was the going back to the older album covers of the red weed and the woman running through for the street, the look of panic on her face, and the as you say, the music. And you can actually get the DVD of the live show, which is awesome. If you haven't got the CD and you want the live show version of it, with the hologram of Richard Burton in the corner of the stage, which is pretty neat, really. You know, considering it's really absolutely worth getting. But Justin Hayward's on that as well, on the live DVD. But it is a powerful, powerful piece of work.
Oh, it is! It's amazing. I love the DVD. Actually, that concert that they did as a live performance, I mean, it was exceptional. You know, to bring a story like that to the stage, yeah, I never really envisaged that you could, but they did.
No one would have believed in the last years of the 19th century that human affairs were being watched from the timeless worlds of space. No one could have dreamed we were being scrutinized as someone with a microscope studies creatures that swarm and multiply in a drop of water. Few men even considered the possibility of life on other planets. And yet, across the gulf of space, minds immeasurably superior to ours regarded this Earth with envious eyes. And slowly and surely, they drew their plans against us.
Yeah. I mean, you couldn't have done it in 78 when it first came out. You couldn't have done it then. I think technically it was impossible. But when they did bring it out, it was really, really good.
And he's really small, Jeff Wayne is, you know.
Mm.
Well, me and Cal stood by him at the a memorabilia show, and we were just standing there right next to him going, "It's Jeff Wayne. Oh, it's Jeff Wayne. Oh, Jeff." And he just looked at us going, "Yeah." See you, Jeff. Bye. Ah.
I hate you. I am never speaking to you ever again. Yeah, I hate it when you do that. You're, oh, yeah. I run into such and such. I go, oh, I wish I was in England right now.
But, yeah, so you gave Rick the album for some inspiration for the music and stuff.
For the music, well, I gave him more just to give him the idea that you could tell a story through music, and it really starts to show through in the most recent story that we did, which is Pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
It was a great script by Mike Featherstone, and from the moment I read it, it really jumped out at me because it was such classic science fiction. It had all of the elements of, you know, look, if this was a story written in the 1960s, say, it would be basically just considered to be, you know, revolutionary genius and all of that kind of stuff. The writing in places, as we discovered, is challenging because, you know, when you've got quite a technical writer and Mike comes from an engineering background and he writes like an engineer, for mere mortals to speak in that more clinical engineering language is a little challenging. But I think that the end product was really good.
Yeah.
But what we did do so much better, I thought, with the Pyramid story, was we told that second story. That story behind Pyramid, which is the story of the characters. Because Mike's writing is so clinical, we were able to tell the emotional story of the characters with the music.
Yeah.
And rather than with the words. And that was just amazing. I think if we were going to do another story quite like this, I'd probably say Mike's script, I think, was nearly 6,000 words long. we would probably do it again with a script that's probably half that length, or probably say maybe 3,500 words. And it would have to be a little bit more broken as a script. In other words, it couldn't be such a contiguous story. Like, it would have to have a bit like Mike's, what Mike did well, and the reason why we could do the music telling the emotional story is because of the way he cut the scenes, and the fact that, you know, he cut it from different points of view, and it wasn't contiguous in terms of time. Like, time moved on, and reasonable chunks of time moved on. So that made it easy to use the music to tell the story, because mm-hmm. when you have a very contiguous story, having a break for the music to tell the story, it becomes very distracting, and it becomes very hard. So it took the right script to do it. But I think that really Pyramid showcases just how good Rick is. Everybody go out there and listen to Pyramid, A, because Mike's story is awesome, but B, because if you really want to know just how good a musician Rick Moyer is, and let me tell you, he is, you know, he's a whole band, symphony, orchestra, everything, rock and roll, guitarist, everything rolled into one.
Yeah, I mean, the good thing as well about your podcast, Martians Are Here, is that you do specials as well. You've done three specials so far. Pyramid was the latest one by Mike, as we've said, which is awesome and really is worth listening. And you've also had A Little Bit of Trouble wrote by Jen Rhodes as well.
Yes. And you know what? A Little Bit of Trouble is a whole lot of fun. I think of the three stories we've done so far, Little Bit is just fun. It's nowhere near as serious as sci-fi for a start. It's more of a children's story, which is awesome, because I don't think that there are... I think children and science fiction go together, but there are not enough children's science fiction writers by far. They're so underrepresented that it's not funny. So hint, all of you listeners who've got half an inclination to write, please go out there and write children's science fiction now. I'll publish it for you, no problem. But this story is just... it's fun from beginning to end, with, you know, terms such as Mr. Icky Yucky Gross, which still lives on in my household. We hear about Mr. Icky Yucky Gross at school all the time. The name doesn't change. The body may change. The name doesn't change.
I mean, it's one of the things as well, where you've got space pirates as well. And who doesn't like space pirates? And for space pirates to get beaten by a robotic gerbil is just brilliant. And a lot of comments on your site from lots of parents. And as you say, science fiction is open for children whose imagination is wild for thought anyway, and should be used more, I think, instead of just being sat in front of a TV. And the responses you've got from and what I've heard is a lot of parents saying how much their children loved listening to it. And I know you did yourself as well, where you got all your kids together and had a bit of a almost like a pajama party, wasn't it, or something, and played the whole thing. To me, that irks back to how I think, as you know, sci-fi on audio, radio, podcasts, you know, it brings the family together, kind of thing. And what a best way than having a children's story being put out there, which is, I think, credit to Jen, but also extreme credit to you as a producer as well, for having a podcast about mainly the Martians Are Here, but then also having, you know, going almost to the opposite of having a fun children's program brought out. It shows variety.
Well, the thing I loved about Jen's story, and the thing that I tried to get across by having the pajama party, I mean, you know what, my kids are up for anything. But, and you look, when it comes to the podcast, they love it. They absolutely, look, it's not, the pajama party that we had for Jen is actually not an uncommon occurrence, where we actually sit down and we all listen. But what it really harked back to me that night was, you know, say the 1950s, with people sitting around the radio, listening to whatever, you know, the Goon Show or whatever, and as a family listening in and joining, you know, and enjoying it together, and none of this, you know, zoned out in front of the TV. Actually, you know, that there was something to it. There was conversation afterwards, all of that sort of stuff, which really harked back to quite a previous time. And I actually think one of the things which I'm trying to achieve with The Martians Are Here, and I actively encourage people to do, is to do exactly that. Not just to listen to it on your iPod by yourself. Take it home, listen to it out loud on the stereo together, because I think it's such a different experience. You know what? It's one of those things where you can actually not just have a personal experience. You can actually share that experience, and in sharing the experience, it actually makes it something bigger. The iPod is the absolute most, in a way, I dislike the iPod because it separates people. It, you know, people put the iPod on, they put their earphones on, and they're zoned out from the world. Whereas I want to use this device to go in the opposite direction, just because that's how it can be used. It doesn't mean that how it has to be used. I think people misunderstand the potential of the iPod, because the real beauty of the iPod is the fact that you can take it anywhere. You can listen to it anywhere. Yeah. And that ability to, you know, sit people down. Like, I have gone to lunch with people and said, here, listen to this. And you know what? It works.
Mm.
I've had that where I've actually said, here, listen to this. And you know what? There's been people two tables down that have stopped talking.
Oh, really? Awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. I did that this week. I went to have lunch with somebody, and we were in North Sydney, in reasonably busy area. And I said, look, listen to this. You'll enjoy it. And we were listening to Pyramid, and the tables either side of us stopped talking. And, you know, I even had a tap on the shoulder. Yeah, turn it up.
You see, there you go. You get into the masses, which is ideal.
Well, you know, I don't know about getting to the masses, but it's more that introducing people to the concept that, you know what, sound is meant to be heard. Mm. And it's not meant to be heard by one person. It's actually meant to be shared. You know, the idea of somebody, you know, cranking up the stereo is not just for their own personal experience, although some people don't necessarily appreciate that shared experience.
It depends what it is. If it's rubbish music, then, you know, then people just shake their heads. But if it's something interesting, it's a little bit different, isn't it?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And the other one was, the one that I wrote, which was Once a Jolly Swagman, which is probably just dark as anything, really.
you always do that. You've got to undersell yourself. You're a shocker. I love Once a Jolly Swagman. I really can't wait for the next part. I've been sitting here twiddling my thumbs going, Simon, shit, finish it now. I could start getting testy soon. I love Once a Jolly Swagman. Here's the reason why I love Once a Jolly Swagman more than anything else, is because I am Australian. And because Once a Jolly Swagman tells the story of being Australian better almost than an Australian can tell it. You have managed to capture the essence of an Australian in one hit. It is just amazing in a science fiction story. This is the first Australian science fiction story where I've gone, you know what? He's Aussie.
I'm gonna put that on a little placard and stick it on my wall when I'm writing it. The reason, interesting, funny thing though, I mean, it's like, how did you come across, or how did you? Because I can't remember now how I ended up in conversation with you. I mean, how did me and Jen? Because I know me and Jen was the first people that you got in touch with. How did we come about to you?
In Jen's case, I started listening to Anomaly podcast even before I started listening to Rick's podcast, and I got really into the Anomaly podcast very quickly, mostly because it wasn't blokey science fiction. And yeah. You know what? I like blokey science fiction to a degree, but then there are just moments where blokey science fiction just wanders off into stuff that I just don't, I'm not interested in. And so I really got into it. And then I was listening to the Ready Room.
The Ready Room, yeah.
Treks and Sci-Fi. And there was one character in the Ready Room that just immediately caught my attention and basically just literally grabbed me by the throat and said, "Oi, listen to me," and that's Joseph de Carlin. Which I don't know who wrote that, Simon. Who wrote that?
Oh, some English guy. Don't know. Does a podcast called Waffle On, I think.
Does he? Okay. Yeah. Well, that one really grabbed me. And what I did was I got into the character of Joseph de Carlin so heavily. Look, I'm just, you know, to be honest, and you know, and I'm I have said this to you before, that Joseph de Carlin is in my top five all-time science fiction characters. You know, and that's in pretty good company because, you know, like, there are people in there who I consider to be, you know, pretty awesome characters. You know, like Doctor Who obviously is a, you know, is a ubiquitous, amazing character. And then you've got people like Kerr Avon from Blake Seven, you know, and probably, you know, even characters like Mel from Firefly. I really digged Mal as a character, particularly in the TV series. I didn't like the movie at all, actually. I didn't like the movie Serenity, but I did love the TV series. And so, you know, to be in my top five all-time science fiction characters is, you know, is a pretty big achievement.
Yeah.
That includes, you know, book characters as well.
Okay.
So I really got into that character, and I just love the way that de Carlin was, you know, he was just... He really typified the Australian character if it went to an extreme. The episodes, like, there was one episode I remember with him just where he's dancing through, like, there's chaos going everywhere, and he's just dancing away with himself through this carnage. And I'm going, oh, you got to love a character like that.
Yeah.
And so I started listening to Waffle On, and I think both yourself and Jen, because I had a connection to your writing through the Ready Room, because I also like one of the other characters which I really liked was I think is it Isla Dredd? Is that the right there? Yep, Isla Dredd. I think she's the Doctor, isn't she?
She is. Yeah.
She was I liked her as a character, and I liked her especially because they had her as, you know, one of the very few instances where the host has outlived the symbiote, and that really, that really grabbed me, you know, as a character of a Trill that didn't sort of stay a Trill. So I got onto both of those characters, and see, I'm a character person, you know, I connect with characters more than, like, that's why I'm not a geeky guy in terms of the tech stuff. It's not the phaser that interests me. It's the man or the woman who's holding it that interests me. So those two characters. And when I read those stories, and I thought, you know what, these two can write interesting characters. I want them to write for my podcast because they can write interesting characters. And if they can write interesting characters, then people will want to hear their stories. And you know what? Everybody who, you know, I keep on being told that your story is PG-13. To some degree, look, there is only one moment in the whole story where I actually feel like it's PG-13, and that is the way you describe the way the policeman dies. That's a bit graphically.
Funnily, that's not as graphic as it was when I originally wrote it.
Yeah, you know what? I had that suspicion somewhere in there. I actually got that impression.
Yeah.
But other than that, I played it to my lot, and they loved it. Want to know the immediate reaction that I had from the people who played it to who were kids, both mine, and I played it to some friends who, you know, and I said, look, you know, it's a bit gruesome, but da 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 da, and the kids all said the same thing. When's the next story? They all felt exactly the same way about it, which was they were just getting into the story, and then it ended, and they went, oh no, that can't possibly be the ending. Look, this can't be right, you know. It's not good. And it really challenged them in that way. And I said, look, you know what, I think that there is a second story, but sorry guys, just don't get your hopes up for a happy ending.
Yeah, no, don't. But then again,
just knowing the author,
you just don't know, do you? You don't know. No. That's the thing.
Well, look, Robert might have a happy ending. There might be a happily ever after in there for him, but I just have my suspicions. I don't know what happens. That's the thing, is that you still haven't sent me the script, so I don't know. If you don't send it soon, I'm probably going to have to come over to England and, you know, break into your house when you're not there. And steal it. Steal both the poster that you have from the original and a few of your Doctor Who memorabilia while I'm there too, by the way.
Oh, hold on a minute. That's fighting talk. That room's locked. No one goes in there. You ain't ever my TARDIS. No way. is there anything you want to say before we go?
Promote. Oh, come on. Everybody knows that the website is www.themartinsarehere.com. And by the way, I always drop the www because I can't be bothered to type the other four characters because the name is too long anyway.
Mm.
And stay tuned because next week we have the first episode of the second part. And this is a special story that is a collaboration between Simon, Jen, and myself. And in this instance, you're going to have to just I suggest to you, do not listen to it before you've listened to episode 12. Do not think you can jump the rails here. You have to listen to episode 12. You have to listen to episode 12 till right at the end. And then I thoroughly recommend that you go and immediately, and in fact, if you're going to listen to episode 13, listen to episode 12 again, because when you listen to episode 13, you'll go, oh my goodness. It is a very, very different story to episode 12, and it sheds new light on the characters, let's say.
Head over to the Martians Are Here website and download all of the past episodes. And as usual, like we say on Waffle On, please do spread the word and tell your family and friends, because you'll have an awesome time listening to a brilliant story. Well, thanks for coming on to the Waffle On podcast, mate.
Bonza. Beauty.
Cheers, mate. That was fun.
Cheers. See ya.
If you like a good science fiction story, then you'll like The Martians Are Here podcast by Australian author Stefan Sonnen. The Martians Are Here podcast is a science fiction serial around 15 minutes per podcast episode set in the not-too-distant future. It's a story about two alien species from very different origins who bring their ongoing war to Earth with disastrous consequences for humanity. The story is told through the eyes of five people who must piece together what's going on in order to survive. This is what happens when biology, technology, and adaptability collide. The Martians Are Here podcast on iTunes and on themartiansarehere.com.